downloading the Demimonde podcast. We are discussing the television series Penny Dreadful. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul.
If you like this podcast, the best way to support us is to head over to iTunes and write us a review. Don't think about it now and forget about it later. If you tend to do that, pause, go to iTunes, write us a review.
You don't have to pause if you're on an Apple phone or an iPod or even freaking iPad. You can listen and still do it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's great about technology these days. You can multitask with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another good way to support us is an Amazon link that we have. Just go to our homepage at noship.net. Click on the Amazon link. It takes you to the Amazon homepage. And then from there, you can do your shopping like normal. And it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of kickback for, you know, blood to draw scorpions in. And
like I haven't gotten my blood in the mail yet. I'm kind of disappointed.
It's coming. It's coming. You need to get Amazon Prime for that.
Any thoughts on this episode before we get into recap?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was swell.
Wow.
Well, well,
that's
well.
Not what I was expecting from you.
Right. Yeah.
Why? Huh?
I didn't think you were going to like the scene where Lily and Frankenstein and Vanessa Ives were having tea. I just didn't think you'd care for it.
I actually enjoyed that the most. All right, I wanted to have some tea myself.
I stand corrected.
Yeah. No, I actually thought it was really good. You know, I enjoyed it. There was a lot of meat and potatoes again. I know I said that last week, but another great episode.
And buns to sop up the meat and potatoes.
Yes. Yes. But I actually really enjoyed it. I mean, it's the show I look forward to during the week. And I can't say that last season. Last season, I mean, I even told you guys I was up and down all season.
Yeah.
And this season actually is a hell of a lot better, I think. I think they really stepped their game up.
Refer to our bonus podcast if you want to know what Paul thought of the first season.
Yeah. I like this episode because it was all about relationships. I mean, it's how some of them will bring the Dreadfuls closer together and some of them are going to bring doom. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, this episode, everything about it was about the relationship between two characters. Even if it was just the relationship between Inspector Rusk and Ethan. You know, the way that they were talking to each other and everything. Something, not that there's a romantic thing involved there, obviously, but like the way that they're relating to each other, it's this whole episode was about that. It was thematic. I think it really worked.
Yeah, I think I had a couple of themes going through it too, because the fact that it's called Above the Vaulted Sky is a reference to the poem I Am that John will quote from. I'm calling him John now, Caliban, because that's what he's named himself. So, and just people connecting with each other and accepting each other for who they are, because that conversation came up for three different pairings in this episode.
Did my bringing him up as a teenager help you with him this week?
I was actually thinking about that, and I was just like, no, it's not helping.
See, I still love him. The more I see him, the more I enjoy his character. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, we'll discuss it when we get to the scene with him and Lily.
Well, he even calls himself out on it. What an amazing actor, you know? He even calls himself out. He's like, I'm a fool. He says it. I'm a fool. I don't know how to talk to women.
I'm a horrible liar. I can't do this.
All right, so we are discussing episodes 5 of season 2, Penny Dreadful, and it is titled Above the Vaulted Sky, which is written by John Logan and directed by Damon Thomas. This episode opens with the wicked Evelyn Poole working on a simulacra of Mrs. Murray. I called that shit, by the way.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, you did. Props for that.
I didn't Seer think, of the week.
I didn't think she was going to do that. I didn't think she was going to go after her. I thought when she was talking about that gives me something to aim for, I thought she was talking in just metaphorical terms, not literally I'm going to aim for this chick's head.
She thought she was out of the way, maybe, but nope. She wants to marry him for some reason.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's how she probably funds her dirty deeds. Keeps finding rich old dudes.
Yeah, and I guess she believes in her spellcraft enough to think that she can manipulate him enough, but we'll talk more about that because I don't want to get carried away, but I don't think he's a good candidate for her. I think she's underestimated him.
Oh yeah, for sure. She's overreached on this one.
So she cracks open the pate of Mrs. Murray and as she does this and the sound effects
amazing
and the look of it, if it's, it's visceral when you watch it.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the special effects crew that made that doll with the brain inside, they need high fives around. That was amazing.
When she cracks open the head, it's like she seems to sense something for a moment, and it could be just Hecate coming up the stairs. But it's almost like she senses something prior to that. So is she, maybe the fact that when you work with voodoo dolls, there's a cost for, you know, causing injury to somebody else, is maybe that's happening to her at that moment.
Or maybe she just so connected to the person she's doing it to, she just kind of gets a little residual off of it.
Yeah. You know?
Well, magic doesn't come for free. I mean, as much as
it shouldn't.
Any of the believable systems of magic that you find in fiction always have a cost attached to it. You can't just cast a spell like you're Merlin walking through the forest and boom, 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 you know, and shoot lightning out of your fingertips. There's always some sort of physical reciprocation for that that has to happen. So who knows what it is? I kind of got the impression that when she stuck that pin in there and it cracked the pate or her forehead, I guess, it when it webbed up, I don't think that was the desired result. And the look on her face was a little bit of consternation, and that might be some foreshadowing that this whole endeavor will not be quite as neat and easy as she thought it was.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. It'll be her undoing. She's not going to make it through the season.
No, no.
No, definitely not. She's messing with the wrong group.
Sam Benny will be the one to finish her off.
And then he'll be like, now you leave Hell's Kitchen.
Okay, so, Hecate has brought up Ive's hair to Evelyn Poole, but she asks if she can do the honors, and Evelyn gives permission, satisfied with Hecate's witchy work ethic.
Well, she's done good. She's pleased her mom or her boss or however you want to look at it, whatever their relationship is, whatever the nature of that is. Mm-hmm. She's a little bit proud of her that she wants to take that extra step. She's showing initiative.
Yeah. I can watch a whole episode in their house.
I know.
And so every time you look into it, there's always something else that I catch. You know, I wouldn't want to sleep there,
no,
but I would love to watch a full episode.
That would not be possible. You just sit in a chair wide awake with no caffeine for, you know, 24 hours straight.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So both work their enchantments, Hecate working Ive's hair into the puppet, and Evelyn puts a hot needle into Mrs. Murray's analogous brain parts. And we cut to her waking and screaming in pain. So, and this is sympathetic magic they're doing. It's using imitation that involves using effigies, fetishes, or poppets to affect the environment of people or occasionally people themselves. Voodoo dolls are an example of fetishes used in this way, such as using a lock of hair on the doll, creating a link between the doll and the person the hair came from. So whatever happens to the doll will also happen on the person. Again, again, there's another source saying there's a cost to the person.
Mm-hmm. She's already lost so much of herself, you know, when she goes into witchery form. There's just no telling, you know, what she's doing to counter that magic already.
Bleeding bodies into her tub, probably.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think that's going to be, I'm calling it now, that's going to be her undoing. What happens at the end of it is all of that's going to come back on her, and she's going to age, like, right before our eyes.
I hope so.
Withered old thing, and then just crumble to dust.
I think
so. Maybe they should just throw a bucket of water on her, and it'll be the end.
See, my theory is Ives is going to reverse the power of the fetish, and she's going to take control of her puppet, and she's going to strangle her.
Oh.
The puppet's
going to
strangle her.
I like that even better. All the puppets come to life. Oh, man.
You get strangled by an Ives puppet.
They're all, like, uppercut punching her.
Yeah, like little shivs.
it'd be just like a Puppet Master movie, basically.
It would be
better. Does it end like that or something?
Well, the puppets kill people.
Yeah, the puppets kill people.
Does the
puppet
master get it?
You need to
watch
the Puppet Master.
Okay. Well, does the Puppet Master get it? Does his own puppets kill him?
I don't remember.
It's been so long since I've seen any of them.
I always focused on the puppets because there was some really cool puppets, flame throwing and all kinds of stuff.
So we have opening credits, and then the next scene opens with the front door has been barred at the Murray estate following the events from last episode. Ethan talks to the Dreadfuls about how close they came to being killed via infiltration. They cannot allow this to happen. He tells the story of how he was ordered to annihilate some Apaches and how he and some other others infiltrated a camp and then killed them all in 15 minutes. We defend our cliff, he says.
That's a pretty harrowing story. And you can tell the emotion that's behind the words that he's saying, especially when he says, and after that, that entire tribe ceased to exist.
Yeah, he hasn't made peace with that.
Well, I mean, it's like he says, I have such sins behind my back that it would kill me to turn around or something to that effect. That's probably a large part of it, to know that you helped in wiping out an entire tribe of Indians.
Oh, yeah. He's like, we just did what we were supposed to. You know?
Yeah, so did the Nazis, buddy. So did the Nazis. Mm-hmm.
It made me think, too, that the Indians were the ones that cursed them, like what M said in the first season.
Huh. Like the Wendigo?
Mm-hmm. Didn't you bring that up? No?
I thought you might have. I talked about Wendigo being related. I don't know. Maybe I did. I don't remember.
He got the Winnebago curse, and now he's...
More on that in feedback. So Ives tells them that the Nightcomers are making a fetish, more specifically a simulacra. Sembene talks briefly of his relative experience of knowing men who must have the flesh of their enemies in order to take their power. Sembene is finally talking, and no one encourages him to continue.
I know, right? I mean, he's the one that's taking everything pretty serious. He's not going to have fucking tea. He's not making, well, he is making cakes, but I don't blame him. I would do the same thing. So, I mean, at least he's focused on the job at hand. He should be in charge. I think they would be better off.
To be fair, he made a cake before all this happened. He's not making a cake now, whereas everybody else is doing something
you don't know
to divert themselves. Oh, he could be making a cake.
That might be how he handles things. He makes food.
Maybe he regrets making the cake.
Oh, no. No one regrets making cake. Come on now.
He's talking about cannibalism, though.
Yeah,
he's
absolutely.
He's talking about how cannibals believe that when they consume the flesh of their enemies, they gain their power and sometimes an essence of their spirit.
So Ethan talks of using everything in their power and knowledge at their disposal. There's a montage of various measures taken, both practical and spiritual. Malcolm Murray has some connections because he gets a metal door pretty quickly. I don't think they have a Lowe's down the street. Somebody hangs these straw dolls, and I had to do a pretty extensive Google search, but I came up with this. So in more recent histories, when African slaves were forced to leave their homes and sold into labor on American plantations, many brought with them small religious artifacts similar to a poppet doll called a fetish. A fetish is commonly a statue or object containing magical power used to protect the owner from evil spirits or to control the owner's destiny. Some fetishes are hollowed out to hold herbs and other magical substances, while others are adorned with special charms and talismans to ward off evil and protect owners.
I do like the Rocky montage we got.
God,
I mean,
damn
anytime
it,
you get a
it.
Montage, it's fucking amazing.
Paul beat me to it. Kudos to him. I was going to say that the only thing that this scene was lacking was the Eye of the Tiger.
Oh. Digga, 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 digga. Yes. Or the A-Team song, you know. And he's like doing his little with the fucking sage. Ah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful.
See, great minds think alike. I thought of the A-Team and Rocky while I was thinking about this.
Right.
But you beat me to it on both of them. God damn it.
Yes.
Even Lyle is participating using Jewish mysticism.
I had no idea that he was Jewish until he put on that yarmulke, and then he gets out his Torah, and then he's got the, I don't know what the shawl is called.
And then he covers his eyes with it, right? When he starts his prayer and he covers his face or eyes.
I think so, yeah.
I don't know a lot about religion in general, and I don't know hardly anything about Jewish religion, so I had a hard time searching for things. Just to put it short, I think when you cover your eyes, especially with certain prayers, it declares that there is no existence outside of God.
Hmm.
So I guess that makes it more powerful.
That makes sense.
And then the covering of the mirror he does later, I think is, I don't know, because that's more having to do with death and mourning.
Mm-hmm.
But it was significant that he looks at himself first and he's
now
feeling guilt for his association with Evelyn Poole.
Now, see, when I saw him look guilty in the mirror, I actually thought that possibly he was not really doing the protection like he should be and maybe leaving a door open for him.
Ah, maybe you're right.
Because they show up in a room later and it made me go, see, he's going to be like, I'm not really Jewish. None of it works. I don't know. I mean, it just made me feel like he's not trying to keep the protection up. Because he even says, you want me to leave, you know, want me to help you? And they're like, no, do what you're supposed to. We'll be fine. So I don't know. I don't trust him. I like him.
That's
I don't
a
trust
good point.
Him.
I think he's going to come over to the good side.
I hope so. I hope he kills himself for them.
No, I want to see Ferdinand Lyle in season 3.
I do too.
He needs to be the dreadful liaison to the museum. I mean, it's a freaking jackpot of information that they're going to have to use in their future endeavors.
That's true.
Somebody's got to get them in there. And that's true. Love Lyle's character, so he needs to be around a little bit. I could an audio tape of him talking about nothing in general. I could listen to that all the way to work.
No, I agree, but somebody's going to die. So, I mean, you guys have to wrap your head around this. Someone's got to.
All right, if you're insistent on that, I'm going with Lily at this point.
I can deal with that.
She died last season, so we're already accustomed to that. So
I'm okay with that. She's the kidney of the show. It's good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Sam Benny needs to stay, though. Sam Benny.
Yeah, well, I mean, God, we got to get to know him. Like, it's really frustrating. We're halfway into this season, and we still haven't gotten much about Sam Benny.
I'm telling you, he's going to get a season of his own. He'll be the main character one season. It'll be about him and
Malcolm Murray.
Yeah, Eminem for sure. They've got to go back to Africa and get Alan Quatermain's diamonds.
He's based on, I think, a little bit. And Dr. Livingston's another one he's slightly based on, among others. Okay. Yeah, so everybody's, like, contributing in some way. Ethan's burning sage. Ives is placing her ward on the wall.
Yeah, they're pulling out all the stops. I mean, just the hodgepodge of everything that you – it kind of reeks of a little bit of desperation, but I can understand that because if those nightcomers can just show up in your house, I'd be wanting to do the same thing,
yeah,
too. I mean, you've got like – you know, Jewish mysticism with Orthodox Catholicism, with African voodoo, you know, mixed with whatever Malcolm Murray was not doing. I didn't really see him do anything except firearms, I guess.
And mm-hmm. the door.
And the door. Yeah, he's the practical one.
Why not get some dogs?
Ah.
Or some cats, you know?
Or they could just, like you know, the pillars that are outside, the Corinthian pillars out there, just tie some priests to those, you know. at the very least, that could provide a somewhat of a buffer, maybe.
That would be in the Monty Python version. Because they can be the knockers, too, like,
oh.
You've got visitors! I hate this job.
All right, next scene. Ives is praying fervently in her bedroom. She's soon being imposed upon by possible astral aspects of Hecate and her minions. Ives becomes overwhelmed with fear, and she runs to Ethan's room for safety. She tells him that she cannot tell if they are real or if they are here. I don't know why he did not go check her room, but he just decided they weren't real without knowing for sure.
He's a cowboy. I mean, you can write a check, but you can be confident and just take care of business. I'm surprised he didn't pull out a pack of Reds and smoke them right then. Don't worry, sweetheart. We're good.
Honestly, though, I think that he took her word for the fact that they weren't there. He believed that they weren't there because there would be a lot more ruckus going on in the house if they actually did appear.
Well, she was really frightened.
I think it might have been the connection that the doll and her might have had. Like the last one, they put the hair on. It made me think that that's when the magic might have first connected. And it gave them a way in. Or Lyle gave them a way in, one of the two. But I think that was just the connection happening.
I think she's seeing them and she's experiencing them in a sense, but they're not mm-hmm. actually there.
Yeah.
So
Ives says she wishes that she were mad and that they would lock her away and cut out the madness. So even what she went through last season is preferable to what she's experiencing now.
God, that sucks. I mean, that just sucks.
She wants a lobotomy.
Yeah.
Or
trepanation.
Yeah, she's saying that's preferable.
Mm-hmm. That means she's only a step away from suicide. You know, I mean, it's right there.
She then decides that God has a plan, and she's saying that as a way to comfort herself. So I think this is going to be the point of no return for her eventually. She's going to lose that faith.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it doesn't happen. But she asks if she can sleep in his room, and like a gentleman, he offers her his bed, and he takes a stunted wooden settee of sorts that he claims is comfortable.
Yeah, right.
Just lay on the ground.
Yeah, it's going to be better than that thing.
And then they have the first conversation that reflects that theme I was talking about, because he says he feels they are who they are because they choose to be, or they have chosen to be in the past. And she wonders again if it is God's plan. And then she says, well, whatever you have done, whoever you have made yourself, I am here to accept you. And she believes that them being together is part of God's plan. He touches her face also before going to lie down. And I think that's important to bring up because she talks about that later, not about he and her, but about what she saw with Lily and Dr. Frankenstein. And he leaves the candles burning for her. But anyway.
It's Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Okay, then. It's Igor.
Igor.
Abby normal?
Abby something. Abby something. But she also touches his face at the end of the episode too.
Right.
So there's that.
There's a lot of face touching.
I think he was nice.
There's a lot of touching, period.
Yeah. So anything else you guys want to say about this scene before I move on?
I like how, like, when Ethan wakes up, Ives is turned into a book.
Yeah, that's.
And she's lying there on the pillow.
She would have woken up with, like, me on the bed with her. Not in a sexual way. I just would have been frustrated with the chair and been like, fuck it. It's just going to be platonic. I'll be fully clothed, but there's no way I'm sleeping in that chair.
Not in a sexual way, but hey.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like I'm going to be waking up butt naked next to her, you know?
Psst, are you awake?
Yeah. I have my clothes on.
Are you up? I know you're scared, but I think we could cuddle, maybe just a little bit. Just a little bit.
It's not cuddling. It's for comfort. You know, the guy needs some sleep, too. That's all.
I couldn't sleep over there.
That chair was murder for my back. She would have been all right with it. He's a gentleman. He's a gentleman.
Yeah. He suffered through that small, cramped, little, supposedly comfortable couch all night for Ives' sake. That's awesome. He deserves points for that.
And as rich as Malcolm Murray is, can you get some bigger beds?
Yeah.
You
know?
I mean, come on. You got a blast door for a freaking front door now. Spend some money on a bed.
Caliban, who we are now calling John, confronts Frankenstein about his evasions. Mm-hmm. Dr. Frankenstein says, go ahead and go see her. I am powerless to stop you. So John manhandles him. Again, I mean,
that's right. Hey,
it's still going on.
If he didn't want this to happen, don't animate bodies for fuck's sake. You know what I mean? Don't give the doctor a pass on this. He deserves everything he gets.
You're right. There's a lot of shit he's done that.
And how come everybody else's look good, but poor John?
Because that was his first. He's learning on him. I mean, I know it's no. I mean, it doesn't make things better for John knowing that. But that is why.
Did he use a butter knife to cut him up? I mean, come on. It's awful. Like, oh, that guy got ran over by a horse. I'll turn him into the monster. Jesus Christ.
I think he was probably using multiple bodies, you know, and then fine-tuning his craft. Okay, I'm taking this too seriously. Moving on. So, yes, he manhandles Dr. Frankenstein a bit and then calms down and questions Frankenstein about what he has said about him to Lily. Dr. Frankenstein is honest about how he has described their supposed relationship status. John sees the wisdom in this, and then John asks him what he has said about his face. Dr. Frankenstein, it seems, has not taken much time to talk about it with Lily, which pains John to hear. But he is then escorted to visit Lily. Dr. Frankenstein leaves him alone, which concerns Lily for a moment. She doesn't want to be left alone with him. Caliban compliments her dress and then notices that she is looking at his face. She says she cannot help looking at it. John says that kind eyes can look on anything and find it beautiful. And then he tells a false story about a walk they took and how she kissed his hand in response to hateful comments directed at his appearance from strangers. Now, if that story was actually true, this scenario would be really sad. But instead, it's pitiful.
Well, it's not pitiful. It's what he wants. It's kind of like a test because it's what he's always wanted. When you're walking through a time period where people could throw rotten food at you, put you in a dungeon and use you as a fucking freak show. The guy, I mean, he's kind of testing her to see how, that's how I look at it. This is how I would want you to be. This is the pedestal that because it's going to happen if they go out in public together. People are going to look at them and be like, what the fuck? You know, so he was kind of like, well, this is how you reacted. And then, of course, she doesn't. I think she can smell the bullshit already.
So you're saying, Paul, you're saying that this is like he's kind of putting it in her mind to where if they ever do go out in public together, that's how he expects her to react.
Yes.
Because she'll remember that. Yeah. Which there's some truth to it because it was Victor who did tell her that when they were, quote, air quotes here, cousins as little kids and there was a thunderstorm, she would crawl into bed with him. And what does she do at the end of the episode?
Right.
And so exactly. There is a lot of suggestion going on here, but I think.
And you got to think he's put her on a pedestal because he thinks he's finally going to get unconditional love. from somebody, which in the past we've seen him try and profess his love, and what happens? I mean, it's disaster.
Lily's given she's giving her love to somebody, but it's not him.
But it's a forced thing, and I like, has he not read anything in poetry about building love on false premises?
No, of course he says he's terrible with women. When if he would just be himself like he was with
Lavinia and Ives,
he would be fine.
Which he's having relative success with them, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's the irony of that. When you try, that's when people say people are trying too hard. Mm-hmm. You know, especially guys when they try too hard to be romantic or to just lay it on too thick, and it's like, look, just be yourself. I just want you to be yourself, and
it rubs me the wrong way though. I have a hard time being sympathetic to him right now.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not really playing devil's advocate here. I think JC was laying it on way too thick.
JC.
John Clare.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, okay. And he's just going way overboard with that stuff. I mean, making up stories and talking about, I mean, much as he is into poetry, I would think that he would want somebody to kind of come to the table of their own accord, you know?
I agree. And he wants that to happen, but because he's not getting anything really from her, I mean, she looks terrified anytime he's around her. You got to think like a high school kid. He doesn't have any game. He's really, if you consider how old he is mentally and what he's been through, I mean, I guess I need to figure out how old he is. I don't know if they ever say how long it's been since he's been reborn.
It's only been a matter of years.
And because it was sloppy, it took him longer. He didn't get his memories like that one guy did from before. So he's really having to learn to do these things all over again. And if you don't have game, you don't have game. You know what I mean? And obviously he doesn't. You can read about love in a book all till your eyes and heart are just full of everything. But then the second you're around people and you can't talk to them, you shut down. You know, and that's pretty much what's happening. And yeah, he's lying. So is Frankenstein. He's just trying to put too much to it, and it's just not working out for him. And it's directed and written so beautifully that it's really done well, because later on when he's talking to Ives, it's natural, and you think, oh, you know, he's got some game already. But it's fairly similar to real life. You know,
you're absolutely right. It's the translation that gets lost. It makes me think of that story. Lenin, the leader in Russia, Lenin, he learned German on his own through a book. Mm-hmm. You know, he learned how to read it, he learned how to write it, and he thought he knew how to speak it. Then he went to Germany, and he couldn't understand a goddamn word anybody was saying.
Exactly.
Because it's just like you're saying, you could read books about poetry and love all day long, but then when it comes time to actually have, you know, to have it where it
practical
counts.
Practical use.
Yeah, practical use. You either have it or you don't.
Yeah, don't you remember talking to boys for the first time in, like, junior high? You know, it's the awkwardest that's there. Steve, I'm talking to you.
I do, I do. It was awkward, you know, when you're in the locker room and you're just like, so.
Nice Johnson.
Yeah.
They just never understood. I understand that.
So, in the end, she tells him that they can only be friends. And he says he understands, and he sits down. And I have to agree with Caliban. I really like her dress, too. I just got to throw that in there.
Now, did you notice when he says, I like your dress, and she goes, Victor picked it out.
Yeah.
And then he says, it's very nice. And she's like, Victor picked it out.
He says, well, do you like it? And she says, yes, Victor picked it out.
That it's like she's infatuated with Victor.
Yeah.
She's in love with him.
He should have stood up and kicked his chair, and it's like, he's a dead motherfucker now, isn't he?
Did you hear Victor, like, run down the steps?
Yeah, that's part we're kind of, like, not even talking about, is that we've got this, like, junior high dance three-way going, and it's kind of, Victor's a creep. I don't like him. He's a creep. You know, he's going to get his. He might be the one that dies. He's already done his job.
JC knows what he's doing. You know, JC knows what he's doing, because he says, like, your plans have been laid bare. I know what you're doing. And he has to be referring to the fact that he's trying to Bogart Lily for himself.
Yeah.
I mean, what else could he be doing?
Yeah, Frankenstein's got some comeuppance coming, for sure.
Yeah, he does.
From several people.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ethan being...
He better hope Ethan gets with Ives soon, because if there's some... I don't think that matters.
I think he'll still be pissed, even if he is with Ives.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. I hope we get it this season. I can't wait. Victor's the one that dies. That's who I want to die. I'm good with that.
So you're calling that. Okay.
I'm not calling it. I just want that to happen.
So So Ethan awakens to finds Ives out of bed and her Bible on the pillow. So we've already talked about that. So Evelyn continues to torment Mrs. Murray's body via the simulacra. The set design for this, which you've already mentioned, Paul,
is stunning.
Super attractive, though it's really horrifying, of course. But I really like the trifold holder behind this, the simulacra. It's like a holder for macabre instruments. You can see where all the instruments are inside that she's using to mess with the puppet.
Oh, it was so graphic, too. It was beautifully grotesque.
Ethan walks out of the door of a gun store and is immediately taken into questioning by Inspector Bartholomew Rusk. We've got Ives waiting patiently at a restaurant when Lily and Victor finally arrive. And I just want to point out that Ives is wearing white after we just learned last episode that she doesn't ever wear white. And you can see her corset is evident behind her blouse. And I was just wondering if that was intentional since Lily has decided to eschew the corset, but we're seeing the difference between the two ladies here, maybe.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I didn't even honestly notice the corset, so that's awesome. But it definitely would show Ives is even before Lily was reanimated, Ives has, what's the word I'm looking for? Discipline, you know what I mean? And it comes through in just everything that she does, even with magic and everything else. She's got the discipline to learn, to hold herself together, to not have sex when everybody else does. I mean, it's pretty everybody. So it's definitely it's awesome. It was an amazing scene too. So I enjoyed it. I'm gonna go back and rewatch it though. Now that you said that,
she has to have the discipline mm-hmm. in order to keep that devil at bay. But oh yeah. You can see the corset, like the impression of it under her mm-hmm. blouse. It's not like it's her blouse is open and, you know,
it's not like Madonna flaunting
her shit. Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think she was wearing white after she had just told us that white's not her color? Is it because she's trying to be a little bit different?
It's just to show that she's a little versatile. It's not my color, but I can wear it and still look good. Remember that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, but that's a good question. Especially since she's going to meet Lily, who is going to be wearing white because, it was decided that would be a good color for her. And then she shows up wearing white.
Perhaps she's less intimidating in white and she knows it.
Yeah, maybe.
Because when she
maybe she doesn't want someone else to wear the same color and look better, so she showed up. Bam! Oh, did I didn't even know you were going to wear white. No. I look better. Remember that, bitch. No, I'm kidding. I think it's to make her feel more comfortable, you know, look, you know, I'm wearing a similar dress, we're having a nice tea, there's nothing venomous going on.
Yeah, it's less imposing.
Yeah, Sim Bene was probably in the corner eating some scrumpets, like, keeping an eye out for her. That's what, I mean, Watchdog, keep him around, I love him.
Okay, so we're now back at Inspector Rusk's office with Ethan, and what is the deal with the plant? Is it a rosemary? I tried to look. It almost looks like rosemary, except it might have a little broader leaf. Mm-hmm. But I decided, okay, I'm gonna go ahead and look up rosemary since I don't know for sure, because it does have a woody stem.
Mm-hmm. I think I know what plant it is. Ah, crap. Go on. It'll come to me.
I don't think it's rosemary.
But no. Rosemary has an interesting bit of folklore. It was used to ward off evil spirits.
It was used to make amazing chicken soup, too.
Yes, and roasted potatoes. But also believe, it warded off evil in general, and if planted near doorsteps, it kept witches away. Mm. But it also has an interesting history with crime prevention, believe it or not. From the 14th century, rosemary root was seethed in wine vinegar, and the lotion was then used to wash the feet of the thief. The lotion was thought to sap the strength of the robber so that he would no longer commit robbery, steal, or do any further harm.
Well, you know why they couldn't do any harm is because they could probably smell his ass coming.
Yeah, probably. Oof. That's strong.
Yeah, vinegar and rosemary. Yeah.
But he picks a piece of it off and he drops it on his desk in front of Ethan.
So if it is a magic, if there is some sort of magic talisman property here at work, it would make sense because when he's in Roper's room in the previous episode, he even says there's magic at work.
Right.
So he knows, he understands something about
the Demimonde. He says it on the train car, actually.
Oh, but... he says it on the train car, my bad. But he still says it, so mm-hmm. he's aware of it.
So that would mean that he didn't come to this conclusion too quickly, that he actually has an awareness of things existing out there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. He might have a background in it somehow. I mean, everybody else in the show has, like, the biggest backstory ever. So who knows?
Yeah. All right.
Maybe he's a puppet.
So he questions Ethan about his sharpshooter theatrical career. Rusk wonders how he survives without employment. He questions him about his time at the Mariner's Inn. He tells Ethan about the murders and that all of the guests have been accounted for except for Ethan and Brona Croft. Rusk talks about the trouble they have been having in London, and it coincides around the same time that Ethan arrived to the city. He does not understand why Ethan is there without employment and buying ordnance. He also tells Ethan that there was a survivor from the Mariner's Inn. And we also learn that Ethan Chandler is not Ethan's real name. Ethan leaves because he has nothing to tell him, and then Rusk asks if he can walk him out.
Well, he handles all the questioning perfectly. You can tell it wasn't his first rodeo. You know what I mean?
Right.
He definitely handles everything right. Like, oh, there's it must help. You know, it's like it's genius. It's genius.
I really like this Rusk character. I hope he sticks around. He's a he's smart. He's really sharp. He knows that something is going on, but he's not trying to force anybody to stay there. He's like, you're not remanded. You can leave at any time, you know. But Ethan doesn't leave because he's intrigued by what this guy has to say. And then I like how Ethan notices that, you know, he's lighting this cigarette with a cool little trick. He's doing it left-handed, and he flicks the match on the box and then lights his cigarette. And he looks over and he sees that he's missing a hand. He has a prosthetic or fake hand. And he says, yeah, that happened in the Transvaal, which, for those of you who don't know, the Transvaal is what is now known as the Republic of South Africa. And when he served in it, Rusk, he would have had to have been in either the cavalry, the infantry, or whatever he was in during the First Boer War, which took place from 1880 to 1881. Since this is 1891, there was a Second Boer War that happened later on, but I don't think it started till 1899. So, just if anybody was curious about what Transvaal meant, there's a river down there, and it's called the Vaal River, and the British referred to that whole area as the Transvaal for, and I think they still do.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't know any of that. It's awesome.
Okay, so now we have tea time continuing with Dr. Frankenstein, Lily, and Ives. Lily practices at being polite. Ives witnesses affection from Lily towards Dr. Frankenstein, and as Ives departs, she suggests that she and Lily go shopping together, and she also watches them from afar.
She knows something's going on.
Yeah, she's no fool. I mean, every time she says a question, either Frankenstein like coaches her intentionally, and then she kind of gives her these like sly little nods. It's like, come on, man,
Yeah, do you
don't
think
be
he
foolish.
told her to say about the city, the excitement being palpable when she had
Yes.
practiced
Yeah,
that line?
definitely,
And then
definitely.
later on when she says about it being noisy or loud, that was her more honest
Yeah,
appraisal of the city.
I'm pretty sure back at the creepy loft they had like a little tea party set up with some bears and dolls. You know, they're like, oh, this is
Cartman.
amazing. Yes. Polyprecipes.
Would you like some tea, Clyde Frog?
Yes, I would, Dr. Frankenstein.
It's so good.
Well, that's what that book was that she was reading out of when JC came up to talk to her. It was pronunciations and stuff and words. It was probably a dictionary, and she was learning what palpable meant.
Is she learning the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain?
So Rusk walks with Ethan. He reveals that he has been trying to get war documents about him. So he must be getting war documents in general from the War Department in the United States, because if he doesn't know Ethan's real name, I mean, he
Yeah.
can't really specify. So he must be looking for
Well,
anything.
he had dossiers on three different Ethan Chandlers. One of them was a farmer from Iowa, another a cotton grower from Louisiana, and a third a scientist from New York, I think, if I remember
Yeah.
them all correctly. But he didn't have anything on this particular Ethan Chandler, and he was able to pick his accent as not of the East of the United
Yeah,
Right.
he's fishing like most cops would when they've got a suspect in. He's trying to get any reaction he can, so he's kind of putting everything out there to see how he reacts. Even when he tells him you're free to go, if Ethan had gotten up right away and left, he would have been acting
Suspicious.
suspicious. Exactly. Even when he's like, "Oh, can I walk with you?" So he's just trying to get any reaction he can, and Ethan is as cool as ice. I mean, that guy's got ice in his veins. He's like the Elvis of the show. I mean, he's smooth. He's smooth.
So they say their departing words, and then Ethan ducks into a shop, and Rusk's man attempts to follow and fails.
Yeah.
He's not real good at what he does.
Nah.
He's super obvious, and then he just goes the opposite direction.
Yeah.
I like how Ethan's still like really polite when he's rushing through somebody's shop. He's like, "Excuse me."
Always a gentleman.
Are we going to get the rest of his backstory this season, you think? I hope we do.
I don't
Give us
know.
something. You think his dad covered all of his trail up because he's powerful? You think it's like a group of werewolves, you know?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I'm really interested. I'm hoping we get through this Evelyn Poole stuff this season, and maybe next season we can focus more on getting to know these Dreadfuls a little bit more. Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's an archbishop, and Ethan served under him for a while, and that's how he cut him off. You know, it's not really his father, but his father. You know what I mean? Like his bishop father.
Oh.
And that would explain where all the money's coming from to bring him back.
The Vatican.
Yeah. I mean, the Catholic Church has a ton of money. And it explains why he knows how to exorcise a demon.
The Pope's a werewolf.
That'd be awesome. Well, maybe they want him back to fight the forces of evil. He's the Lord's Hound, isn't he?
Everybody knows the Pope's a werewolf. I mean, that's not really a revelation. Come on.
Come on.
So at the Cholera Food Bank, Ives and John talk some more poetry, specifically about John Clare. He begins to quote the first stanza of the poem, and she finishes, and then she quotes the final stanza because it's made up of three. They then talk of their failures with love. John calls himself maladroit when it comes to strategies of love. She teaches him how to dance, and I love how they can be friends, and he's not crushing on her and ruining it all.
Exactly, because he's comfortable. Mm-hmm. He's being himself. You will love him even more in this scene. It's just when he's trying too hard, he turns into the 14-year-old creep.
Yeah. Plus, he's already got his plate full. You know, they're, like what you guys are talking about is more true than what I'm saying. But he also has his plate full. Like he's part of him is crushing on Lavinia, you know, poo-poo mm-hmm. Putney. But then part of him is crushing on the bigger part is crushing on Lily. So he doesn't have a whole lot of room for new romantic endeavors, as one-sided as they might be.
That, and if you think about it, him and Ives both went there to kind of get away and reflect. Because they both feel almost safe or comfortable down there because everybody else has got just as many problems as them. You know, I really do think that's why he goes down there. No one's going to judge him because look at what they're going through. So it's easier to talk to him when you're sitting in the worst possible medical ward ever.
Yeah.
True, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, who's going to be like, hey, I'm not taking soup from that jackass? You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Who cares?
It was one of my favorite scenes of the episode again. It was just really nice. It made me feel comfortable. And they're in a dirty, nasty cave. You know, it's like, all right. Maybe she'll throw him a little, you know, help him out a little bit. That's all he needs. That's all he needs. Get it out of your system, you know?
I don't agree or support that.
That wouldn't help at all.
You know, some Whitney Houston starts playing in the cave.
It's getting worse. I do encourage everybody to go read that poem by John Clare. It's called I Am, and it's a beautiful, beautiful poem.
But like Vanessa said, you know, poems are for sad people, songs are for happy people, so.
I guess I'm both, because I like both. So Ethan finally arrives back at the Malcolm Murray estate, managing to lose his law enforcement shadow, except he has acquired a new one, the mysterious Mr. Roper.
Yeah, Leatherface is following him around.
So Dorian and Angelique are at the opera. They went to go see Wagner. Wagner is precursor for homosexual sex when it comes to Dorian because he was playing Wagner before he and Ethan got it on.
It works him up.
Yes, so it's a cue. This is a similar scenario to what John Clare had lied about to Lily.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
It's not outside a tavern. It's inside.
It doesn't result
a...
in spit also with
right.
Caliban or John Clare, but yeah. I actually love this scene. I love seeing Dorian Gray pick up her hand and kiss her hand like that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you want it to be genuine, but you know in the back of your mind, she's still in trouble. You know, it's like, oh, he's nice, but he's just a predator in his own right.
Are you getting that sense?
For sure.
How
For
come?
Sure. I don't know. Once you said it, and then you kind of watch his movement, the way the actor portrays him, he's very predator-like. You know what I mean? He's got that killer behind the mask type thing. You know what I mean? Like what we see on the outside is definitely not what it's not what's in the inside. You know, he's because maybe he's such a sexual all the time, bang, 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 maybe that's what's throwing it off for me. That we're not seeing in the other side that he's just dealing maybe it's a coping mechanism. I don't know, but I feel like something bad is definitely gonna happen to her now. Because he's always cool and collected kind of, you know? He's too smooth. He's not Elvis.
I don't know if he has any ill intentions towards Angelique. I don't think he's got any designs on her that are going to spell, you know, her doom or anything like that. I just think that there's probably going to be, what's the best way to put it? A set of circumstances that's going to bring that about.
Yeah, because what happens to his lovers when he's tired of them? Does he break up with them, really?
Yeah.
No. No, it's going to be bad. I'm on him. I'm with him on this one, for sure.
I don't know how he's going to do it, but it will be devastating. So, also at the opera, Evelyn Poole continues to enchant Malcolm Murray and even takes some of his blood with her ring.
Mm-hmm. Thank God it wasn't like the cows. Holy shit.
He just collapsed. Lyle shows his current discovery regarding the devil's narrative, Lupus Dei. I have a question, though. You know, everything's so serious. They got a metal door, and they put all these, like, charms and shit up in their house. But Malcolm Murray is out hanging out with Evelyn Poole at a frickin' opera.
They're having tea in the middle of town. I'm telling you, the only one that cares is Sam Bennett. That's it. That's it.
Well, everybody's got to blow off steam, maybe.
Even the tea in the middle of the town was done in the middle of the day, which they had already said was safe from
right,
the nightcomers.
That's true.
Because they come at night, well, hence the name. So really, only Malcolm can be accused of a dalliance here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he's doing it as a diversion, or I don't know if he knows something more than we do.
Well, are you going to tell Malcolm Murray to stay home?
Yeah. No. He's kind of the boss.
Yeah, so I'm the boss.
Everybody's living in my house. If I want to go out and get some, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So, and maybe that's the attitude on display here.
Could be. He just seems kind of dopey.
And do you think, what do you think she was doing with the blood? I have a theory on this.
Well, I have a theory too, which we see it happen again, and that's where my theory.
Yeah, me too. All right, I think we're on the same page.
It's
yeah.
just like Sim Benny said, you know, you get the blood or the flesh of your enemies, and you mm-hmm. can, you know, control them.
Yeah, I think she was fueling those kids at the end with it.
Yeah, because that's the source or the result of their joining.
Exactly.
So she has to have his blood to help formulate that
exactly
plan, for lack of better words. As I was saying, Lyle shows his current discovery regarding the devil's narrative and his Lupus Dei to Ethan. Now we're seeing that Ethan's fate is tied together with Ives.
Yeah, directly.
Prophecy.
I mean, fuck.
So yeah, if Ives believes God has a plan, then you know she may absolutely be correct.
Is it God that has the plan, or is it the devil?
It could be a mutual thing.
What?
I mean, it's all one world, right?
One love.
The plan could be bigger than God and the devil, let's just say.
Well, I hope, you know, maybe it's a warning. I don't know. I'm hoping that everything works out.
Jerry's still out on this scene for me because he holds up I think it was less about what the continuing narrative was and more about connecting Ethan to it through the stone that said Lupus Dei on it.
Was it a stone or was it like amber? I thought there was like
a
bug in it.
There was a bug trapped in amber in there.
What kind of bug?
I don't know. It looked like a cockroach, but I don't know.
What a disappointing piece of amber. What'd you get, cockroach? It totally changes Jurassic Park.
So now back at Dorian's, Angelique has changed into men's clothes and she talks about her trials in life, fighting to be who she wants to be. She is tired from fighting for so long. Dorian says she is not fighting alone. And she asks, like, okay, am I still not fighting alone if I continue to dress this way? And Dorian says he cares for who she is and not what she wears.
She's just trying to find out if the interest level is still there, if she takes away the facade.
Yeah, it was a test.
Look, I'm a guy, you know what I mean, with some long hair and some feminine features. Are we still good? And Dorian passes the test, and he says, hey, I care about you. I don't care about how you dress.
Yeah.
And this scene was really important because it really solidifies their relationship. It's not just some dalliance that he has. And this is what leads me to believe that he doesn't have any will towards her. He doesn't have any bad designs on her. I'm not saying that something bad won't happen. I'm just saying that he is not going to be the one to make it happen. He's not going to be the catalyst.
Well, go ahead.
He might be interested in having a relationship with somebody like her because he's always interested in doing something new and something different and adventurous. But eventually that adventure is going to cease to be an adventure and then he's going to drop her to the wayside. So that may be what's going on. So at this point, it's not a bad intention or it doesn't seem like it, but it will turn out to be that way. And the thing is, when he said this thing, it sounded very heartfelt and everything, but thunder peeled out right behind it.
He's too silver tongued. He's too. He always knows what to say to whoever he's trying to bang. No matter what, he knows what to say. Even with Ethan. I mean, he swooned a fucking cowboy. You know what I mean? So it's that he's always got the right thing to say no matter what, dude. Maybe that's why it bothers me so much. He always knows what to say. It's like in the Bible when it talks about the snake in Garden of Eden and all that. You know,
the gilded tongue.
Exactly. He's too smooth. Too smooth. I need him to make a mistake. Now, we could have a sideshow, like 5 episodes of JC John Clare getting some pimp training from Dorian Gray. Right? It could be a good little sitcom maybe on a Friday night. It'd be amazing.
It's like Ives and Dr. Frankenstein's shop for clothes, and we've got Dorian and John Clare.
Really, really testing the patience of the Penny Dreadful fan base here. Well, what we got is it seems like Dorian Gray is being seen here by you guys as like a 1891 bisexual version of Don Draper, to where he can just get his way by talking himself into anything, but he's only interested in the beginnings of things when they're fresh and new and unique as an experience. And then after they become passé or everyday, he wants to move on to something else.
Well, not every day, but when you're as old as possibly Dorian Gray is, life gets mundane. So why not just keep trying to get more and more? But, you know, eventually, that's what I was saying earlier about where are his exes. You don't see him ever talk about an ex-wife, ex-boyfriend, or anything. So it just leads me to believe that eventually he's just going to get tired of it. And that's why he really wanted Vanessa Ives, too, because he could probably sense all the... I mean, that's an interesting woman. You're not going to meet too many possessed.
And he still hasn't even... completed that adventure.
Mm-mm. You know it's eating away at the back of his mind that that's the one that he couldn't sleep with. I mean, Lord, he slept with a cowboy. He can do anything. He can do anything.
He slept with Vanessa Ives.
Yeah, he just didn't finish. Yeah.
Well, that doesn't count. He didn't finish. I mean, that's probably even more frustrating. He probably wanted to finish and have sex with a demon.
Oh, it counts. I don't know. If you were counting, it would count. That's what I'm saying.
I would count it. That's the half. He's had sex with 5 and a half women.
How do you get to half? Well, it's a funny story.
All right. So Malcolm Murray is unable to control himself with Evelyn. She takes him upstairs to her hotel room. Dorian and Angelique have sex. Ives meets with Ethan on the staircase, and they look at each other longingly. Sex is happening with Malcolm Murray and Dorian. Evelyn again punctures Malcolm Murray with her ring. The blood from him apparently allows her to form a hallucination of the Murray children in Mrs. Murray's mind. Mm-hmm. Their tombstones appear and they begin to claw their way out of the graves. Ives and Ethan at the top of the stairwell. She touches his face and then walks down the stairs away from Ethan.
That was the sexiest of the three scenes, in my opinion.
But you know what?
I was hot.
Really curly, and that worried me. Because it's very much like Hecate and Evelyn Poole. So I'm like, is that really Ives?
Or well, is it that was Hecate raining. The humidity makes your hair curl. Come on now.
Yeah.
I think if that was, I see what you're saying, but I think if that was Hecate,
she would have banged him.
She probably, yeah, there would have been something else that would have happened too. That it wouldn't have just been that scene.
That night has not ended.
Yeah, I don't think she's subtle enough to pull that off to just be there for a second to touch his face.
And he would sniff her out.
You're right.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
He'd get down like a dog and smell her butt real quick. You know, like,
you're not Ives.
No. Yeah, that was a sexy scene. I mean, that they stared like that, it's like, stare sex, huh? Right there? But they know Sam Benny's downstairs watching the front door, so you can't do that.
Stare sex on the stairs? Is that what you're saying?
On the stairs. Stare sex on the stairs. But it was sexy that they just kind of like had that moment. I mean, that it seemed to last forever, you know? I liked it.
There was the montage of sex scenes was pretty cool. I mean, Mary Moon would be proud, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I can tell you this, though, that Malcolm Murray hasn't had that much fun in the bedroom since the night he made Vanessa. Oh.
He had a goofy-ass grin on his face.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why I feel like I have to bring that up.
But you do.
Yeah, because it's not the first time I was like, God, he looks so goofy. I would have been like, get off me.
Maybe he's just the most uncomfortable doing those scenes. Like, everybody else had no problems, you know. And then she was even, the woman that he was with seemed to be comfortable. Maybe that's just the one thing that actor's like, you want me to what? I mean, they were just about fully clothed. I mean, let's be real.
She had a corset on.
Yeah, there was only whatever nudity was present in the scene between Evelyn and MM was tastefully done. And it contrasted because you've got the very naked Dorian and Angelique doing the what.
But do you think that was symbolic in a way because they were more open with each other? They just revealed these things to each other. And then you have more of things are hidden with
because
Malcolm
they're
Murray
subterfuge.
And Evelyn. Yeah.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
Dorian's
a
little bit more of a perv and just wants all the lights on, some spotlights, somebody taking pictures on the side, you know, with the old school camera. I mean, he likes to have records. You know, he's got a butler that brings him the time he slept with the girl that had that disease. You know, for that one. She's coughing up blood. All right, we're good.
We're good.
Maybe he's Batman.
So what do you think the significance is of the fact that they showed so much of that sex scene between the two men? Because in the first season, there was a sex scene that happened between Dorian and Ethan, but all you see is a kiss. Do you think that this was at the discretion of the actors, or was this something that the director said, we want to push this forward? I'm glad they did it, but I'm just curious as to you guys' opinions on why it was so much more explicit than they had done in the first season.
It seems like this season they want to push the envelope. You know, they're killing babies, you see bloodbaths, you see a lot more this season that, like, shocks you. You know, it's like, whoa, you don't see that very often on shows, you know, and this was a pretty graphic man-on-man scene. You know, so I think it was possibly pushing it, and possibly the actors were comfortable doing it also. I don't know if the guy that plays Ethan would have been comfortable to going that far. I mean, that was...
I think it's great that they did it, though, because there's
absolutely. I mean, it gives more realism to it. If you're going to show a man and a woman having sex, why not, in this day and age, not show two men having sex?
You know, maybe they showed it between Angelique and Dorian rather than Ethan and Dorian is because there's more stakes to the relationship now. Like, we're seeing that they're, with them having sex, we're seeing them actually form a bond where, you know, I think it was supposed to come off as more of just like a one-night thing with Ethan and Dorian.
Maybe
that, right?
Having those two sex scenes going on at the same time kind of shows both of the predators going after their prey and getting what they want. Because they're both like a yin and yang with Evelyn Poole and Dorian Gray. If Dorian is bad like him, and I think having those two go at it just shows it's a victory for the dark side, you know?
So how does this third sex scene fit into it then?
Okay, well, getting to that. All right. So, yes, sex continues as well as thunder continues to peal in the background. So all of these unions are going to amount to something not good. Mrs. Murray slits her own throat to free herself from her torment. Lily is frightened by the storm and runs to Dr. Frankenstein's bed. And this dreadful finally gets laid.
Yeah, that was very... Well, he found a virgin to have sex with him, you know? Even though she's not really a virgin, but she is.
He could have put her hymen back in place.
I guess she's a born-again virgin.
Yeah, that would be for sure.
She did used to be a whore.
It was typical, you know, and it felt, compared to the other two sex scenes, it felt like, you know, oh, I'm in bed with you. Mom, don't wake my mom up, you know?
Talk about the clothing. I mean, you don't even see Victor's butt.
It was definitely a sexy storm, though. I mean, maybe everybody in London was fucking at this point, you know?
the deleted scenes of that sexy storm is going to have Lyle and Sembene in the broom closet. They're the only team up that we didn't get to see.
Yeah. Oh, well, we didn't see John Clare.
Yeah, John Clare.
That's true. John Clare is probably just sitting there reading poetry because he's a gentleman.
All right, let's do the feedback.
All right, feedback time.
Feedback.
I'm going to start with Mike Gorham's Twitter, his tweet on Twitter today. And he says, at No Ship Network, does Caliban know or understand that Victor is on drugs 24/7? His evil Biff Tannen routine is old. Ha, won't work on stoners. Response.
I mean, it goes along with what I said. Biff Tannen was a teenage bully, so I mean, it's awesome.
But he was a goth.
So, are we gonna get a scene where Victor's like a British accent? Take your goddamn hands off!
Oh yeah, for sure. You put two coats of wax on my horse today, huh?
Yeah. I wonder if we're going to see any more of Victor and his drug habits.
Yeah, we kind of dropped that. That was something that was exclusively so far in season one, unless we're just supposed to assume that he's been on drugs the whole time, but we haven't seen him shooting up.
I don't think he's doing them. I think he's focused on Poontang.
I'm pretty sure he said he was addicted.
He could have kicked, but I mean, that would have been a story point.
Yeah, he would have been sick for a while. I don't know. It's a good point.
All right, next up, Daniel Dewing. He says, first, the only way to watch the series is via closed caption. The vocabulary is so rich that I have to look stuff up afterwards. Yeah, there's a lot of great vocabulary. Uh-huh. Next, Ethan and the Inspector dialogue was great. Lots of cat and mouse there. As a 50-year-old guy, Evelyn Poole is so hot in a corset. She could make me do bad things. Take me to the dark side with your bad self.
Yeah, she could literally make you do bad things, whether or not you want to.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember the guy on his
knees.
Not
necessary. You don't have to be a 50-year-old guy to think that she could make you do bad things. It's okay.
Okay, I could.
I was waiting for that one to sink in. It just didn't. I was like, oh, okay, all right.
So I could watch a whole hour of Vanessa and John Clare talking about poetry, life, and love, mesmerized.
I agree completely with that.
His next sentence, finally, butt stuff. As in B-U-T-T, butt stuff. Also, good luck, Victor. You're going to need it. Like usual, not a lot happened, but I was completely immersed in the Penny Dreadful universe. That's not a bad thing. Dan Dewing.
No, I agree with Dan 100%.
This show is one of those shows that like makes you forget about whatever's going on in your life for the 45 minutes that you're watching it. Like a lot of shows I can watch and I'm into, but you know, problems about like work or this or that or the other thing, something that's just kind of like stewing in the back of your mind will come up. But like with Penny Dreadful, for some reason, I'm just totally immersed in it and I forget about everything else.
The whole Victorian world is the production design. It's no wonder you get immersed in it because they've done so much with that.
Yeah,
they must have a lot of money for their budget. Supposedly in Ireland and maybe in other European countries that you get a tax credit from the government for filming there.
Oh, wow.
And so that helps with like production costs. I don't know if that's true. I learned that on Reddit.
This is filmed in Ireland. So
yeah. Well, Dan's doing a great job at. I'm sure he gets that all the time. Sorry, Dan. But thanks for the email. Points taken.
Yes, thanks, Dan, for doing such a great job.
Just keeps rolling off the tongue.
All right, next up, Bib.
Let me strap into my seatbelt for this.
Get ready.
So I've got a couple of her her tiny emails, and then her stream of conscious email. So we're going to start with the tiny ones. And she says, it has been a while since I watched season one, and it's good to go backwards. The seance with Madame Collie is really fun to watch again, knowing that what she is to become, and how I did not recall that Dorian watches Vanessa in the alley after she leaves. Oh, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
He was watching Vanessa get it on with a stranger. And then she says, how did I miss that episode 7 covers 4 weeks' time? It's not in the episode, but it's on the DVD info. Wonderful to watch them all bond. And what the hell happened to Dr. Frankenstein's morphine addiction? That time also explains how Brona is so close to death the next time we see her. And I remember why I have such a Jones for Dr. Frankenstein. Give her the last rites and get the fuck out of this house, you ridiculous man. You remember that?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was cocaine that he was doing.
I thought it was morphine.
I think he gave morphine to Malcolm Murray to help him sleep, but he was doing cocaine.
He's probably not just doing one drug.
I mean, come on. None of that was illegal back then.
And she says, looking forward to the podcast. Well, here we are, podcasting.
Boom.
And then she wrote, X-Men shout out. Morlocks are a fictional species created by H.G. Wells for his 1895 novel, The Time Machine.
That's true.
They dwell underground in the English countryside of AD 802-701 in a troglodyte civilization, maintaining ancient machines that they may or may not remember how to build. Their only access to the surface to the surface world is through a series of well structures that dot the countryside of future England. That reminds me of a conversation with a homeless man years and years ago. And this guy drank urine. Moving on.
Ooh.
You guys are great. Love the discussion, theories, and possibilities. I have no need to spoil anything. Just curious about what anyone knew about the source materials. Fuck Twilight. Hee hee.
Yeah.
People are freaks. Glad you're along for the ride, Paul. Venus and Furs, free on Kindle. It's that damn old. I did not put any of the potential Putney mayhem together, and I watched the episode twice. Damn, love that theory about Caliban being king of the freaks. The freaks will rise.
Wait, what's on Kindle?
Venus and Furs. The S&M book she was recommending.
Oh, yeah. I got to read that, don't I?
The one you were already downloading.
Oh, yeah. I got it already. Well, I forgot all about the Morlocks being in H.G. Wells stuff. That's fucking fantastic even bringing it up. But it was in the answer.
Yeah, don't forget that.
Okay. Now we're to Bibb's stream of conscious regarding episode 5. And she says, puppets. It had to be puppets. I feel bad for the dismembered puppet she's torturing. Is that Fat Mother? It is Fat Mother.
Oh, fuck.
Endora enjoys Samantha being sassy mother-daughter team from hell.
I could just see, like, in the credits, like, that lady's name, and it just says Fat Mother.
That's Ethan awful.
Ethan and Siege talk. U.S. Cavalry equals Victorian witches. Sturdy locks and a shitload of weapons. Defend Cliff Ives. Glad to see improvements of Bond Manor, though it's starting to look like the Cut Wife's place. More scorpions, please. I think Ives is great, but I want to ease the crease between her eyes. It looks painful. She's got those 11s.
It's consternation.
Sam Benny, watch her in the stairs.
Well, I mean, he's the man's focused.
He's the Stairmaster.
I like that. Stairmaster. Naked bitches, better run to Ethan's room. No, Vanessa, you do not want to go back to the nut house. Stick with Ethan Wolf and his old praying habits. Lupus Day, indeed. I know what it is to be scared of the dark.
Do you? Do you really?
Acceptance all around the Dreadfuls are rapidly replacing the Scoobies as my favorite band of evil fighting misfits. You talking about the Scoobies from
Buffy?
Or are you talking about Scooby-Doo?
Scooby-Doo, right?
No, she's talking about the Buffy. Scoobies from Buffy. She better be.
Yeah, I think she is. She's a Buffy fan.
No.
She is a Buffy fan. No. She told me.
The Scoobies from Scooby-Doo Paul didn't actually fight any Buffy. Evil.
I did not. Don't you sick Bibb on me, goddammit. Don't you dare. I'm gonna watch it. I'm sorry, Bibb. I'll watch it. It was Buffy.
Well, if the Scoobies are going to get replaced by the Dreadfuls, I can see that. That's legit for sure. But they're going to need to fight some evil here soon because they keep getting messed up by it. You know what I mean? They keep letting it come in the house and smack them around. They need to have an Empire Strikes Back moment where them being the Empire.
Point, Return of the Jedi.
Maybe that'd be more appropriate.
Yeah, it's all right.
Do you think, I mean, Ewoks versus Nightcomers?
Hey, they beat the fucking Empire, didn't they? They could take on anybody. With Jar Jar, dumbfuck Jar Jar in the lead.
Paul's an Ewok apologist.
Hey, I love the Ewoks.
No, he's an Ewok fan. Ewoks don't need to be apologized for.
That's right.
Okay, more bickering at the Frankensteins.
Frankenstein. How many times do we have to correct you on this? Jeez.
John Clare, screw your courage to the sticking place. How are either... Did I read that right?
Say it again.
John Clare, screw your courage to the sticking place.
Ooh, what is the sticking place?
Yeah. Screw your courage to the sticking place. How are either of these idiots going to get anywhere with a woman of Billy Lily's history? Even in her current state, they are outmatched. All this lying backstory is going to backfire. Side note, her eyebrows drive me nuts.
Me too. Just shave them.
I don't remember what's up with her eyebrows.
So this is the second comment in one Gmail about eyebrows from Bibb. So she's just getting distracted, you know. Like somebody walks in the room while she's watching the show. What are you watching? I don't know, but look at those eyebrows. Look, just look at them.
Inspector Rusk, you are strange and off-putting. Lost what? He's missing something? Recent trouble at the inn. Long on understatement. Ethan isn't Ethan. What?
She's talking about his hand.
Yeah, maybe.
I think it was a subtle thing. He looked at his hand.
Yeah,
and,
it was very subtle.
Yeah, I didn't catch it until the second viewing.
I didn't catch it at all.
Being in the war and stuff like that, in the Transvaal and stuff. Mm-hmm. But his right hand is prosthetic or just not there, whichever one.
Over tea, Ives does not recognize Brenna, who says this amazing thing. As long as he'll have me. Oh, girl, you are trouble.
She doesn't recognize her because the last time she saw Brenna was...
It was quick.
It was quick, and she looked completely different. She had a different accent altogether.
Okay, meanwhile in Cholera Town, the quote of the episode occurs.
Cholera Town.
All sad people like poetry. Happy people like songs. John Clare, any other woman connects better with you than Billie Lily. This scene also contains the best exchange of the episode. We're all awkward in love. I am so maladroit, Miss Ives. Followed by a dance in the time of cholera. Good one.
That's awesome.
Won't you take me to a cholera town?
Love the Bond, Castle Gate, and Gatekeeper. What a wonderful second life these characters are having. I wonder what Shelley and the gang would make of it. Mr. Wilde would want a percentage. Percy Shelley. Okay. Dorian, you may have won me over with your defenses of Angelique, but Em, I fear you are right concerning her. I sense doom. That is the prettiest man, seriously. I care for who you are, not what you wear. Lovely. And then you hear thunder behind it. So yes, something's going to happen. Okay. And Bond, she's a breath of something, all right, but it ain't air. Hilariously, the word Randy popped up in the subtitles during this scene.
Sweet.
Ooh, I hear laughter in the rain, walking hand in hand with the one I want to demonically possess. A hotel, how convenient. Mr. Bond, I expect this of Dorian, but really, sir. Billie Lily climbing in bed with Victor is such a bad idea. She wasn't a whaler, son. Oh, look, she's naked again. Well, I'd hope Victor would release some tension. Congrats, Doc. It was a dark and stormy night, and everyone had sex.
Yeah, I'm telling you, everybody in London got nucky. Maybe Victor will come out like with a smoking jacket. It'll be all smooth. You know, when he shows up at the Dreadful's house again, they're all going to look at him like, what the fuck? Yeah. He's going to be like, yeah, fellas, guess who had sex with a girl last night?
He's going to start singing, I just had sex.
He'll try unsuccessfully to get high fives from everybody. They just look at him.
Yeah.
Come on, come on.
Till Sam Betty just smacks him.
Sweet Jesus, there are dead children in the bedroom. That was horrible.
Oh, the kids are coming out of the fucking ground.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of people having sex. So I was like, where were their dead children in the background? I don't remember that.
Evelyn Poole's got dead babies all over the floor, you know? Don't mind them. Don't mind them.
Don't look. Don't look them in the eye.
It's hot.
Afterthought, I would have appreciated Ethan telling Ives she was right about sensible shoe witch. Not a Pinkerton. Not by a long shot. Until the next full moon, Bib Fortuna.
Oh!
Oh! Thanks, Bib.
Yes, for sure.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we need to watch... I need to watch two shows because of Bib now. And read a dirty book, right?
Yes, you're all racking right. them up.
Oh, if I only had more time in the day. But I like to know... I like that she binged watch the first season. That's awesome.
Next ones are from D. Cody. And this one, she's... this was before the episode, and she was wanting to encourage that I continue with my Wendigo theory. She's worried that I'm not supporting it anymore, it sounds like.
Well, after this episode, it's definitely a possibility with the whole Native American fight, you know, his stories about it.
I like it, and I hope that it, you know, that it does, because it would make it more interesting. We'd have another entity or mm-hmm. creature that, you know, you would have to contend with to make it more interesting, you know, until we actually start seeing evidence of that.
Yeah.
He's got to show signs of cannibalism. So,
I don't think that's a dead end. I just think that we haven't gotten enough evidence for it yet. That's all.
For anything, for either way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably more closer to the fact that he's a werewolf because he was probably bitten by Ethan or scratched. And mm-hmm. so he could, next full moon, he may transition. But does he even need a full moon? We don't even know. Ethan just got angry and then beat their asses.
Yeah, he pretty much hulked out.
We don't know what the trigger is, really.
Mm-mm. Maybe no, it's don't. Dog bones. I don't know. Biscuits. Some begging strips. Mm-hmm. Begging strips.
All right, so Decody's comments on episode 5. Mother-daughter bonding time. Dessert, mother? No, darling. You go ahead. Let's chant while I finish cracking this egg.
Ooh, nice.
Romp and pomp before the stomp. If able, most soldiers will add sex as a must in their pre-battle preparation. But holy cow, did Penny Dreadful go full on with this pre-climax climax trope. Thankfully, Ethan and Vanessa did not kiss or join the other pairings. I prefer this pacing for their potential union. Oh.
I don't think they ever hook up.
In fact, I'd say their time together was more intimate than any other intercourse. She's agreeing with you, Paul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, Eva Green and Travis Fimmel, Ragnar Vikings, are amazing at saying and conveying everything without words. Talk about hair of the dog hangover. His wife slit her throat, but Eminem's ache will be far worse. Bloody Mary will be his dessert. Better yet, have a peppermint and ginger tea potion, but I don't see his remedy fixing his pain anytime soon.
Oh, no. He's going to be ultra, uber guilty and don't want to hang around that house when he finds out he cheated on his wife the night she killed herself.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's going to be fucked up.
Mad K wasn't kidding when she said she knew what to aim for. Eminem should have picked up clues at the shooting range. She's not only a sharpshooter, she's a master sniper. Though subtle, Lyle warned him. They are under attack. Vanessa said the attacks would be at night, but he still ventured out past dark. It seems a kiss seals the deal with the devil. He is now at her mercy.
Well, yeah, he's been spellbound by her, because if he hadn't ran into her in the perfume shop, who knows if he would have done any of this.
Why don't you quote Malcolm Murray at this point, because that hasn't been brought up yet, what he was saying at the opera.
Oh, yeah, okay. There's a part at the opera where right after that guy spits in Angelique's face and the two of them walk away, and the camera focuses on Malcolm Murray and Evelyn, and he's saying that it's really just a myth. Quicksand doesn't kill you. It doesn't swallow you up. Mm-hmm. It just holds you down while you're trying to fight it, and then eventually you get away. I'm paraphrasing, not quoting, by the way.
Nice.
And I think that's a metaphor for their relationship coming up. He's going to be held down for a little bit, but he's not going to be swallowed up by it. So,
nice.
That's just what I'm going with. It's bad news for him in the short run, but in the long run, it's probably bad news for her.
Okay, this is off topic. We're going to cut it. But did you know that there is a fetish for quicksand?
What?
I did not know that.
Yeah, they
How
brought.
So?
I guess there's whole websites for it where it has people sinking in quicksand, like girls or guys. It's really fucked up. Kevin Smith talks about it in a webcast. Jesus Christ, in a fucking podcast that he does. And his partner talks about it, hearing it on, not Invisibilia, but the other one. Another one of the NPR podcasts. Uh-huh. I guess they mentioned it for half a second. He's like, wait a second. And he said he looked it up and he fell down the rabbit hole and was just amazed that there was a fetish for quicksand. Of all the things in the world, quicksand.
I can almost imagine it, though, because there's like that thrill of
helplessness, rescue.
Yeah, like something there. There's like that weird, like what you feel on a roller coaster. You know, there's that risk
exactly.
That's involved. That's exciting.
Crazy. I didn't mean to bring it up.
It is crazy.
But,
yeah. I wouldn't do it.
No.
But I can imagine it.
Do you think if that's the way you have to get off, they're building quicksand pits in their backyard? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's just crazy. It's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
Okay, back to what we were doing. I just figure I'd spread the word about that weird fetish. That's what Dorian's going to do.
He's got a quicksand pit, like next season. Where's the hunt them down and kill the beast Maverick now? Has he lost his purpose so much that he's beguiled so easily? Obviously, yes. Now, where is 007 going to go from here? We got a death, Paul, but could Eminem be set up to die this season? He can't. Mm-hmm. He's the daddy.
Possibly, but I doubt
daddy?
It. It's possible that he's the one, but I don't see it happening. You know, I think Frankenstein's going to be – I just feel it.
I think all the characters are getting broken down to low points so we can see them rise again at the latter part of the season.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Malcolm Murray's still got to work through some shit. They're not going to kill him just yet.
Although Evelyn Poole would be good with, like, the boots are made for walking theme song wherever she goes, you know.
Will it be Lyle, Vanessa, or the collective family working together to redeem him? Now, Vanessa is not the only one that needs protection and the cure to find peace. I'm thinking part of that answer still rests in that puzzle of where Chef Sembene will finally come to the rescue in a big way.
Yeah,
Chef Sembene now.
He's the key. He really is. I like it that he's going to be the one that maybe breaks Malcolm Murray's trance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, once he figures it out, it's going on.
Yeah, because
he is worried about him. He said so to Ethan. Well, he didn't say, but it was implied. It appears Angelique may not be in Lyle or Madkay's clutches. I like that Angelique called Dorian out. Even better that Dorian countered that bluff with his continued endeavor. Holy cow, does Showtime show it? For a long while now, Dorian's frame story only appears to demonstrate choices between who you are and what you want to be. Okay, I got that. Molasses drip drip. Oh, so it's a slow drip. Molasses
it's a slow drip.
Drip.
Of molasses. It's like it's getting doled out very, very little bit at a time. We may not even get the reveal this season. So just be prepared for that.
But hooray for the preview and sweet tidings. We might get more chaos, or rather movement, with Dorian's party invitation. I don't think we didn't watch him this time.
We chose not to watch the previews this time, I think is just out of like time's sake. And I kind of like to know, not know what's going into the next episode sometimes. So sometimes I'll watch them and sometimes I won't. But this time we chose not to. So we're going into the next episode completely blind.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
I'll go ahead and read her paragraph here, though. But hooray for the preview and sweet tidings. We might get more chaos, or rather movement, with Dorian's party invitation. I will go ahead and say, if Ethan does not recognize or smell Lily right off, then I'm going to be sadly disappointed. I'm already sulking, noting in the same preview that Vanessa's sixth sense didn't pick up Madkay right away. She could pick up a witch, vampire, or Madkay in the snowy park. Sight unseen and before the chant, but she can't see or sense a dark mistress right in front of her, even after her training. Huff and puff, I am, I am. So I guess they're going to encounter each other. That's what it sounds like.
Ooh. No, she'll sense. She'll know. I think she'll know, maybe. I don't know.
We'll see, because previews can be tricky. They can.
Yeah.
Yeah, the previews lie.
And it's not like she had a full round of training, you know? It was kind of like
right.
Broken.
She's probably done a lot of, you know, self-directed training mm-hmm. on her own since then. But yeah, you're right.
Although it would be...
she also,
go ahead.
She also only knew that she was under attack from something in the beginning of this season when she was in the snow. She didn't know who it was from or why. She just knew that she was under some sort of magical psychic attack. So it wouldn't make sense that she would have to like, you know, that she would necessarily see, you know what I mean? See her or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So second cousins do sleep together in Victorian times, and she has a little happy face right next to that.
These second cousins, at any rate.
Yeah, well, they're not really cousins. Just remind everybody.
Lily doesn't
spoiler
know that.
Spoiler alert.
I'm glad Victor finally got some. Of course, she's not his real cousin, but wow, did he play this one all wrong from the get-go. He did a masterful job in making it seem like she broke his virginal core. I've never seen Doctor Who, but she got moves in Secret Diary of a Call Girl. She's got breathing scenes down pat.
Go ahead, Paul. This is Paul's dream girl
sure
right here.
I didn't say it was a dream closely. Girl. All I said was she was my one of my favorite. Well, she is my second favorite Doctor Who companion. That's all.
Lines between those eyebrows right there.
Check it out, Bib. You should see these lines right here on his eyebrows.
Consternation on his face about Rose over
there. Hey, what can I say? I like her. I didn't know she was the diary of what?
The Secret Diary of a Call Girl, which I've seen the first episode of that, and it was
that a Showtime show as well?
I think so.
Interesting. The whole Dr. Frankenstein finally getting laid thing, I guess. It was still creepy to me. I don't care if he gets laid.
It is creepy.
As long as he takes a bullet for one of the other dreadfuls, we're good.
The director shot these sex scenes differently. Dorian and Angelique were close up from below. Madkay and Eminem were clothed and laterally shot, and he finished with the shooting Victor and Lily from above. Well done.
Yeah, I didn't really notice the difference. I was just looking at the
dig.
I couldn't take my eyes off it. But the differences like qualitatively between what was going on with the three different sex scenes. I wasn't really noticing the cinematography so much, but that's a good point.
I wonder why? Like, what's the point of view of these cameras were supposed to be?
I mean, it was three different types of sexual encounters, too, though. You've got two really passionate people having sex. You have with Dorian and Angelique. You have two people having sex with, it's, I don't want to say not as passionate, but it's different circumstance. You know, they were, one person is being beguiled and taken advantage of by getting blood and everything else. And it wasn't as passionate. There wasn't maybe any love involved. And then you've got these two people who have never had sex before. It's two completely or three completely different scenarios. You know, that's why you can't do the angle with, it's not like Dr. Frankenstein, who's never had sex, is going to come as strong as Dorian, because Dorian's very experienced. You know, Frankenstein's level of shooting is probably not even close to what Dorian could do.
His level of shooting?
Well, I mean, you know, it's just it's three different types. I don't know if camera angle has anything to do with it other than just the circumstances of the people making love. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
One group was fucking, one group was making love, and one didn't know what the fuck they were doing.
They were unique to their own situations, but I don't think there can be too much read into, and it was a nice touch to have three different camera angles for it, but I don't know if anything can be read into the fact that they were so drastically different.
Yeah.
In fright, Lily ran to Victor's bed like Vanessa ran to Ethan's. The gentleman took the couch and the other will take a coming ouch. Thank you, Ethan. And is it me or is Lily still having a hard time breathing even without the corset? She seemed to keep holding her stomach. When she put that napkin up to her lip at lunch, I was sure I was going to see blood drips. Did Victor actually replace her lungs or just zap her? Well, I think that's why she's got the scars, is because they did get replaced.
Yeah, I believe so, too.
It would make sense.
Meanwhile, back in the mansion, Sambeni is making a lovely red velvet cake with beet juice. That's how you did it back then.
Mm, I didn't know that.
It didn't come out of a box. Mm. So, thanks, D. Cody.
The shooting thing is just, I can't get over it.
How about the coming ouch?
Yeah, that too.
That's hilarious.
Last one is Dunkin' Donuts. Hasty evening, dreadfuls. Needy caterpillars, house projects, and a migraine nearly prevented me from sending feedback this week. But in the wise words of Sir Lyle, we are nothing if not tenacious. Once again, an amazing episode. I had to take off half a point from a perfect 10 for those zombies, though. I mean, really, they were quite humorous. I felt so bad for Mrs. Murray. All those years of putting up with Malcolm while he obsessed about Africa, traipsed about the world, banged the neighbor, and eventually killed both of their children, and that's the thanks she gets. Yeah, it's a pretty miserable life.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm wondering if the hold Madame Collie, Evelyn Poole, has over Malcolm is temporary to certain moments. When she pricked him with the ring, he seemed overcome, and then again when she cut his neck. But it doesn't seem to be very strong between incidents. Yeah, I'm confused a little bit. I mean, I think partly because I want to believe he's
better than that.
Like he can overcome it on his own, but it's seeming that I'm wrong.
I don't know. It seems like he noticed whenever he got cut, whenever he was getting handed the glass of brandy, and there was a look on his face like he knew something was going on. But then later on, she cuts him in the back of the neck with it while they're making love, and he doesn't seem to notice that at all.
Well, of course, you're in the middle of having sex. It's not like...
Yeah. It's going to be a lot less noticeable.
He'll notice it in the morning, like, oh, got a little freaky. A little blood.
Cut myself shaving.
But, I mean, of course, I mean, she's a powerful witch. So, of course, I mean... By himself, we want him to be stronger, but he's not. You know, it sucks.
We'll see.
Paul, when Vanessa and Caliban were talking about poetry and how sad people quote it, all I could hear was you talking about him being an emo teenager. I couldn't help but chuckle. Paul's smiling.
Well, yeah, it fits. It totally fits. That's why I like his character, I think, more this season. It makes me laugh.
There were some truly creepy moments. The poses of the demons as Vanessa prayed. The gooey brain, the juxtaposition of the storm and Mrs. Murray going crazy versus all that lovemaking. The actress playing Mrs. Murray really screamed her heart out. I had to watch that several times to screen cap, and it was actually quite disturbing, despite the silly zombies. Did you guys think the zombies were silly?
I thought the zombies were a wasted opportunity because they weren't scary.
Yeah.
And we've had every other kind of horror trope in this show up until now, it seems like. So why not throw in some zombies? But it wasn't executed as well as it could have been. But having said that, it didn't detract from my enjoyment of the show. It didn't pull me out of my suspension of disbelief because I was going, look at those. They look fucking stupid. So, yeah, they could have been better, but I didn't really feel like they were silly, I guess.
Yeah, I could see. They weren't frightening at all, that's for sure. You know, but I guess if you were in your bedroom, it wouldn't take much to frighten you at that point either. You know, you're in the middle of the night, your kids crawl out of their fucking graves. It doesn't have to be too frightening to be effective.
Yeah, I will say this. If you think you're actually seeing that in front of you, it doesn't matter what they look like. You're going to be freaked the fuck
out.
But
I think maybe some dead parts, you know, some guts. You could have got a little extra.
Pieces falling off.
Mm-hmm. Some maggots. Have the maggots come out of her mouth like in droves. That would have been good.
That moment between Ethan and Vanessa on the stairway was everything. I'd kill to know what was on her mind at that moment. She looked like she was in one of her dark moods, and I'm not sure he even breathed that whole time. Then he closes his eyes as she walks down the stairs, and I'm like, I know, bro. I can't believe you didn't kiss her either.
Wasted opportunity. But well, I think it was like DeCody said that we're saving this for a better time. I think it's going to be a bigger like event than they didn't want to. It was a tease in a way because everybody else is having sex and it's like, okay, these two are going to have sex too. But you know what happens when Vanessa has sex. So this is saved for later.
Do you suppose all of the names on the chalkboard were his aliases as he moved to avoid showing his age? I took a screenshot of them, and they all had his age stated as older, 47, 52, but his height seemed accurate, 5'11". But could he pass for 47 or 52?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think he could.
Maybe he just picks those names because they're dead people, you know, like in several other movies that they've done that. You know, you need an alias, find somebody who's died, and then just pick up from where they left off.
We're talking about in Rusk's office, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
She says, I do have some Portrait of Dorian Gray thoughts starting to formulate, but so far I'm not getting a strong direction. It was interesting that both he and Vanessa told their counterparts that they were there to accept them fully, no matter what. I'm wondering if there is a darker side to the coin, as in one is a good relationship and one isn't, or if it's simply a repetition of theme. She goes on, one hidden moment of acceptance that I really loved, though, was Sir Lyle in the basement, getting in touch with his Jewish roots in secret. He seemed so relieved and happy when he touched the Torah and more like himself afterward. I don't know, but when he looked in the mirror, he was...
Shame.
I don't think it was good.
Not from his religion, just knowing that he's entangled with the people he's trying to protect his friends with, you know?
Yeah, he's conflicted. He's torn. That's why I think he's going to be a triple agent. You know, he's going to go back and help out the Dreadfuls in the end.
He's going to be a swing state.
Yeah, swing state.
He's definitely in the most danger, almost. You know.
Well, it's interesting though that they didn't threaten him with death. They threatened him with exposing his dalliances, and he would lose his marriage, he would lose his job, he would lose his position in society. Mm-hmm. So that either leads me to believe that those are the things that he's most afraid of losing, even more than his life, which I can't really buy, or that he is somehow important and they need him just as much as the Dreadfuls do.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure which way to go on that, but why wouldn't somebody like Evelyn Poole have threatened him outright with death?
The theme development was so strong this week that makes this show such a pleasure to watch and deconstruct. Hand kissing and hand touching everywhere. Victor and Lily and not Caliban from his story. Dorian and Angelique, Evelyn and Malcolm turnabout on that one. Acceptance and scandalous outlier relationships. Even the opera was about that. The Valkyrie is about a struggle of supernatural beings over the world and an incestuous relationship. One extra thing that gave me pause. Inspector Rusk said he'd been injured in a war with the Boers, which was in Africa. Is this simply to tell us that he truly is a worthy adversary or something more? Sorry, these thoughts are scattered everywhere and probably tardy. In the meantime, beware of the ridiculous baubles of our vanity. Dunkin' Donuts.
I don't know if that's thanks for the letter.
Yes, thanks. And I'm always checking for your Gmail up until the very last minute. Dunkin' Donuts. It's fine.
She tries to get it in. It's like slide it in right at that last second. But I don't know. I think it was just to add a little bit of texture and backstory to Bart Rusk's character by saying that he's been in a war and he actually suffered some injuries. I think you can read – the easy thing to read into that is that he's a formidable person. He made it through that conflict. He came back mostly in one piece. Mm-hmm. So he's not somebody to be trifled with. But other than that, I don't know. I mean, time will tell. But he's one of my favorite new characters of season two. So
yeah, I agree. That and Leatherface. I want to see what happens with him.
Yeah.
Stark.
We know as much about him as we do about Senbene.
My side, your side. Yeah, the Senbene thing is gonna, at what point do we like draw the line and say, okay, we're upset about this? You know what I mean? Is it two more episodes, three more episodes, the end of the season? When do we get the full reveal on him, and in what form does it come?
I think it'll be soon. I hope, you know. He's going to be the one that saves Malcolm Murray from the Weeotches.
Think so, for sure?
I think so, yeah. He's the watchdog. Not taking anything away from Ethan, but yeah. I'm telling you, he's the one that's always got his head in the game. That's why you need him around. He's the Chewbacca of the group. Don't fuck around. Let's get it. Let's get the Millennium Falcon fixed. Why are you fucking around? I'm telling you, you need Senbene.
All right, anything else you guys want to say about this episode and feedback?
Thank you again to everybody for sending it in. Don't forget, all this goes towards our contest. And
that's right. We didn't talk about the contest.
Well, we can.
Yeah. Paul, like, we've seen pictures of the mug he's making.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. I want one.
Yes, yes. So. I'm going to tweet out a picture, like a not of the full thing, just kind of like a little teaser picture, just to maybe, you know, like at an angle where you can't quite tell. So probably by the time this drops on, what, a couple days from now, you know what day?
Tomorrow night. Late tomorrow night.
Hopefully then or Friday morning I'll have it up just so everybody can kind of see. And, you know, we keep track of everybody's points. So if you go to at No Ship Network or at Molten Forge on Twitter, you can see the preview. And just by sending everything in, it's just going to help us out in the long run and help you out. So don't forget, the big thing to make points is to go on iTunes and give us that review and just be active with everything that we do. And then at the end of the season, we'll post it up and hopefully everything, you know, the glazing process goes well. I bought some new glazes to kind of try out with it. So just cool. Keep up the good work, guys.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. The feedback is always some of the most fun stuff to do.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
Thank you for the feedback. Thank you for listening to us. Thank you for the reviews we've gotten lately. And again, if you want to support us, that's the best way to do it, is to write reviews or write us feedback.
Yes.
So that's it. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul.
This podcast has been brought to you by
Axolotl Tank Productions
and Esoteric Studios.